If you're itching to go on a summer shopping spree, wait just a minute. There are five things we should be sure never to buy in the summertime, according to our financial expert this week. We'll find out what they are just ahead. It's On Your Money. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kevin McKinley is off this week, but our guest this week has plenty of advice for making wise decisions with our money and getting the most bang for our buck. If you have any questions, the number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is onyourmoney@wpr.org. My guest is Lauren Lyons-Cole. She's a financial expert and personal finance contributor for TheStreet.com. Her work has been featured in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, The Today Show, and other national media outlets. Her website is laurenlyonscole.com, and she joins us today from the Argo Studios in New York City. Lauren, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Cynthia.
Well, President Obama issued an executive order that aims to make it easier for 5 million people to pay off their college debts. How does it work?
Yeah, so this is actually a pretty big deal. There are already, for recent graduates, people who have taken out student loans since October 2007, they are already able to repay their student loans at a reduced rate. It's set to 10% of your income. That's called the pay-as-you-earn program. The thing is, for a lot of people who have student loans who might have taken them out before October 2007, they're still struggling to get by. So what Obama is doing is extending this program to everyone who has student loans, not just recent graduates. So this is a big deal.
Wow. So now it limits them to what amount?
Right. So the payments are limited to 10% of your income. Rather than calculating the payment just based on the loan and the standard terms, you can actually use your income. You just link it up with the IRS, actually. It's pretty simple. And you can get certified for a lower payment. Now, granted, this stretches the terms out for quite a bit longer, up to 20 years. And over time, people are going to pay more in interest, but it makes that monthly payment smaller, which makes a massive difference for a lot of people. Like you said, 5 million people.
And who are those 5 million people?
They're student loan borrowers. Generally, it's people who have taken on more student loans than they can technically afford. But this could be people, it might be lawyers, it could be doctors, it could be people who are career changers. Maybe they went to school for one thing, could have been expensive, and now they're doing something like maybe they're a teacher or a job that's not paying quite enough to make their student loan payments.
So this doesn't take effect until December 2015. What should these people do in the next year and a half before that kicks in?
Fortunately, there is a program in place. It's called income-based repayment. A lot of people are familiar with this. So if you're having trouble making your student loan payments, and if you're a recent grad, by all means, look into pay as you earn. But if your loans are older, then go with income-based repayment until December 2015. But keep an eye on the news. Set up a Google alert or something so that you know when this goes into effect so you can switch your payments to something lower. This is particularly true if you work in public service because there's a program called Public Service Loan Forgiveness, which will forgive the remaining balance of your student loans after 10 years of on-time payments. So pay-as-you-earn is a really good option for those people who are in public service who are working towards having their loans forgiven.
And what's the best way, generally, to pay off student loans? Should we try to pay them off as quickly as possible, or is it better to maybe just make the minimum payments and pay it off slowly?
It's such a good question, and it's an interesting thing. It's stressful. We've got $1.2 trillion in student loans in this country. A lot of people are in the boat of trying to figure out how to manage these payments. And when you have I think the average is about $30,000 in student loans. When you have that kind of debt hanging over you, it's tempting to want to pay it off quickly. But I really recommend making the minimum payment. If you can afford the standard payment, make the minimum standard payment. If you can't, then use income-based repayment or pay-as-you-earn to reduce your monthly payments. But don't stress about paying too much towards your student loans because we have to remember there are other financial responsibilities. We have to have an emergency fund. We need to save for retirement. If you have credit card debt, you need to pay that off. So student loans are a piece of our financial picture, and it's important to, do some deep breathing or yoga or something and reduce some of the stress that you feel about student loans because paying them down quickly is really – it's not the right answer for most people.
Well, it's scary to think about the fact that if I have to file for bankruptcy, I believe student loans are not are in some way immune to that. I'll always have to be paying them off.
That's the current state of things. Yes, student loans, are, you know, like I said, it's a big problem, $1.2 trillion. And so policy is going to continue to evolve. It's, if you have student loans, it's important to watch what's going on in Washington and how that affects you. You know, bankruptcy is really a last worst case scenario for a lot of people. And chances are there are so many different programs. That's why things like pay as you earn are important to prevent people from needing to turn to bankruptcy as a solution.
We're talking with Lauren Lyons Cole. She's a financial expert and personal finance contributor for TheStreet.com. Her website is laurenlyonscole.com. And we're taking your questions at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at onyourmoney@wpr.org. Also in the news, a recent survey by BMO Harris Bank showed that 28% of Wisconsin parents with small children do not have any emergency savings. One in five parents has less than $1,000. It sounds bad, but a BMO Harris regional bank president says she's seen anecdotal evidence that shows that parents are starting to get back on track after a rough economic period. What's your take on the situation and your reaction to the survey?
It's definitely reflective of not just Wisconsin, but the entire United States. And I think that, you know, I do hope that Americans are moving towards building up this emergency savings. And that's why I like to point out, and, you know, in relation to student loans, there's so many other things to be focusing on with our finances. And I think that having at least 6 months of living expenses saved up really can protect people from ending up in a stressful financial situation. Just God forbid something happened, like a big medical emergency or unemployment.
So how do we do that? If we're already feeling strapped, we feel like we don't have enough money to even set aside, how do we even get started?
Yeah, so it's not exactly the most fun goal. I'll admit that. Emergency savings funds. It's really the type of thing where you want to be slow and steady is going to win the race. You know, it's not something that you're going to get to your goal within 6 months' time. It could take 3 years. And I think it's good to just recognize that up front, that this is a long-term goal. When it comes to calculating how much money you need to have saved, there's a quick way to do it, and it might be a little bit of an eye-opener. If you take your rent or mortgage and multiply that by 2.5, somewhere between 2 to 3, you can pick the number, and then multiply that by 6, that's going to give you a rough estimate. It's a quick calculation of how much emergency savings fund you need to work towards. When you see that number, it's easy to think, whoa, that is a lot of money. You know, for some people that could be, I mean, it could be up to $50,000 easily, but it could also be like $15,000. So it's a range. You need to figure out what's right for you and then set the goal. Know that's what you're working towards. And on a monthly basis, even if you're setting aside $50, start, you know, chipping away slowly but surely.
How do you arrive at that equation? Why is it 2.5 to 3 times your rent or mortgage times 6?
So it's kind of actually just backwards thinking. A lot of experts will recommend that your monthly rent should be about 30% of your income. So if your monthly rent is or mortgage is about 30% of your income, we can, you know, work the other way and say, well, then we'll multiply that by 3 to figure out how much we're spending on a monthly basis. You could really only multiply it by 2 potentially if, in theory, you're saving a big chunk of your monthly income. So somewhere between 2 to 3 is a good number for most people. And I think when you get, you know, calculate that number, when you figure out how much you need, it might be a little bit overwhelming. So it's important to set small goals and celebrate when you reach them along the way. So if you have nothing right now, aim to get to 1,000. And when you get to 1,000, do something fun, you know, celebrate those goals. Then you can aim to get to 10,000. 10,000 is a good number. And from there, continue to build your financial security and your whole overall financial picture. A good challenge, actually, as we're going into summer, for people who are looking to build up their emergency fund would be to go on a spending fast. So this is something that I recommend. It's, again, maybe not exactly fun, but it's an interesting challenge to don't buy any clothes, no shoes, don't buy coffee out, don't go out to restaurants, cook every meal at home. Try to do this just for a month. It's temporary, but you'll be surprised to see how much you can jumpstart your savings just by going on 1 month of a spending fast.
Sounds like something to do in the winter when you don't want to go anywhere.
That's probably a better idea.
But no, that's it. And in the summer, though, there are a lot of great free things to do as well. So that'll help us save our money. We have a couple of callers lining up for you. Let's take Artis in Jefferson first. Hi, Artis.
Hi. I have a 32-year-old son that lives with me. Since he's graduated from college, how many years ago, he's had one part-time job. He just can't seem to get a job, and I'm concerned that when I'm gone, how's he going to survive and then be able to get a loan at a decent rate when he's got a huge college debt?
Yeah, so that's a good question, Artis, you know, and I think I have a feeling you're not alone. I'm sure there are a lot of people who are in the same situation, and it's been a hard time. A lot of us, and I'll tell you, I'm 32 as well, so I understand people in my generation, it's been tough, economically speaking, and getting a job, especially when you have student loan debt. So it sounds like there might be maybe a more holistic approach you could take towards working with him to try maybe focusing too much on the job thing. It might be easier for him to start small, right? So if there are other things in his life, if you're trying to get him to a point where he can go out on his own and pay rent or, you know, support himself, maybe you can identify little goals along the way. And is he working right now?
No. The last job he had was several years ago. It lasted for one school semester as he tutored grade school kids in math, and he enjoyed it, and he got praises from the teachers. I don't mind him living with me. He's a big help. He cooks. Mm. He does the shoveling. He does the mowing. He does the laundry because I am a widow, and I am working full-time. So when I get home, supper's ready. So I don't mind him being there, but I just am concerned that when I'm gone, what's he going to do? Because if he tries to get a loan for a car, it's going to end up being an exorbitant interest rate, I'm afraid, because he's got this huge loan that he can't get paid off because he can't seem to get a job. He's applied all over the place and nothing.
One thing, Artis, do you have credit cards yourself that are in your name?
Yes, I do. I have three.
Okay. Is he an authorized user on any of those cards?
No. The only one he's an authorized user on is my debit card for the bank. And unless I tell him use that card, he does not use it. He is a very frugal young man.
That's good. That's excellent. So even if he's not going to use those credit cards, you can help out his credit score by putting him on the card as an authorized user. This way, it'll show the amount of credit you have available to you will also show as available to him. And so that'll help him to recover some of his credit score a little bit. And then the student loan is a whole separate issue. He's definitely going to be someone who's going to want to watch what's going on in Washington with how this is evolving. But that's one place you can start. There's also a site called creditkarma.com where he can check his credit score for free. So you may want to have him check out that site, and then they'll give him tips on other ways he might be able to raise his credit score. In consideration of the loans that you're concerned about.
Thanks for that call, Artis. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this week is Lauren Lyons-Cole, a financial expert and personal finance contributor for TheStreet.com. Her website is laurenlyonscole.com. If you have any questions for us about personal finance or investments, you can give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is On Your Money. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine, and we're talking with Lauren Lyons-Cole today. She's a financial expert and personal finance contributor for TheStreet.com. If you have any questions for On Your Money, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And our email address is onyourmoney@wpr.org. Lauren, let's take a call from Ronald in Iola. Hi, Ronald.
Hi, good morning, Cynthia, and good morning to your guest. Regarding President Obama's 10% option for student loan repayment, would there be conditions where the repayment of the 10% wouldn't even cover the interest due on the loan? For example, if you took a salaried position at General Motors as compared to a much, much smaller company.
Yeah, that's absolutely possible. And which you bring up a good point. So, you know, because you don't really want to have someone in a position where they're paying until the day that they die on their student loans. But that's not what this is designed to do. So the 10% caps the payment just, you know, based on their income. And then after 20 years of on-time payments, the remaining balance is forgiven. So basically, it creates a system where someone can make an affordable payment for a arguably reasonable amount of time, and then the remaining balance of the loan is forgiven. If that person works in public service as a teacher, something similar to that, the time frame is only 10 years. So this isn't the type of thing where someone's going to be stretching out and not even making their interest payments over the course of the rest of their life. So obviously, this can be seen from a lot of directions. But financially speaking, for people who are struggling under their financial loans, this is essential for them to be able to maintain a standard of living.
Thanks for that call, Ronald. We'll go next to Lizzie in Eau Claire. Hi, Lizzie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm really interested in this whole conversation. It's been really good listening. I think you were really right when you say slow and steady, Laura. Savings is something that comes over time. I'm 26. I have $45,000 in debt from student loans. Right. But like you said, get on the income-based repayment program, get on the public loan forgiveness program, do a couple years of AmeriCorps. I did that. That's an option, Peace Corps for people. I'm just a waitress now with a baby. And I am now wondering, what should I do with savings accounts for my child? I didn't have any savings for my college, but I'm thinking about her. And there's IRA options in these 528 programs. And I'm just wondering what I should do for that.
Sounds like she's wondering, too. I can hear her in the background there. She was like, yes, Mom, what are we going to do? Lizzie, I think you're raising such good points, and I'm really glad to hear that you did AmeriCorps and that you've got, you know, a track for your student loan payments. Sounds like you're not stressing about it too much and slowly building up an emergency fund, especially with a baby. That's an important aspect of your finances. But here's the thing. A lot of parents want to provide for their children, especially those of us in this generation of student loans, right? We want to have college savings, and it's actually a 529 plan that you can set up. But from my perspective, don't do that until you've set up your own retirement savings. Because the good news is we can get student loans for college. We can get scholarships. We can work and, you know, take a little bit longer to finish college. We can go to community college. There are options when it comes to education. There are no loans for retirement. So absolutely, I want you to be contributing. It sounds like in your situation, a Roth IRA would be a really good option. And then best case scenario, if you end up in a situation when your daughter's ready to go to school where you have more retirement money than you know what to do with, a Roth IRA is a potential source for helping out with college payments. But if you need that money for retirement, then we'll know that at least you're on the right path.
Sound good, Lizzie? What was that?
Do you think Roth IRAs are safe?
Great question. So a Roth IRA is just a tax-advantaged retirement savings account. So by contributing money to a Roth IRA, you are contributing after-tax dollars towards your retirement, which you will never pay taxes again. So between now and then, the contributions will grow through investing in the stock market, will grow tax-free. Now, investing in the stock market is never foolproof, but historically, the stock market has returned, you know, about an average of 8% per year. So although we might have years like 2008 again, we might also have years like last year, which was a great year. So investing is really about having a long-term perspective. You know, you're 26, you're not going to need this money for 40 years. So if it goes down, you've got time for it to recover.
We're talking with Lauren Lyons Cole on this edition of On Your Money. She's a financial expert and personal finance contributor for TheStreet.com. If you have any questions, the number is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Do you need advice on paying back your student loans or saving for emergencies? Perhaps what to do in order to make a major purchase like a home or car? We're taking your questions via email as well at onyourmoney@wpr.org. Lauren, you were recently on NBC's Today Show talking about whether it makes more sense to buy or rent certain things, including a home. So let's start there. When should we buy and when should we rent?
Homes are an interesting situation because we tend to think it's always better to buy, and people see homes, purchasing a home, as a long-term investment. But interestingly, as I was just saying about the stock market going up an average of, 8% per year, homes have only increased on par with inflation historically. So they're really not a great return on your investment. Now, they are a form of forced savings because by making a mortgage payment, you're essentially building equity in yourself and in your home that you can turn around and use later. But if you're not so sure, if you're living in a city right now and you're not 100% sure that you're going to stay there longer than a year or even 3 years, maybe 5 years, it might be a little too soon to start dumping so much of your money into a home. There is, the term cash poor exists for a reason. So there are times when renting is a better decision. And there's actually, the New York Times has a fantastic calculator. It's the rent versus buy house calculator. You can go on Google, look for it. It'll be the first thing that comes up. And you can discover, based on your exact situation, what's better for you and how long you need to stay in the house to make it worth it to buy instead of rent.
And you even talk a little bit about cars.
Cars. Now, cars, I think that leasing is tempting because you can have a beautiful new car every few years. But really, leasing is really a luxury. I mean, almost always when it comes to cars, it's better to buy. And of course, financially, it's better to buy a used car that's already got the depreciation of value. So you're not paying for a new car right off the lot that's going to drop in value. But leasing is, can be a good option if you get a really good deal. I think Ford had some great deals recently, and every now and then you'll see that pop up. But if you're going to lease a car, you need to be a meticulous driver. You have to keep it in perfect condition and pay close attention to your miles. So generally speaking, I'm going to say that buying a car, particularly a used car, is the best financial decision.
Mm-hmm. And, a lot of people are looking at I was looking at some of your notes, and you had mentioned camping gear even. I wouldn't have thought to rent camping gear.
Right. I know. I just learned this myself, actually. And I think it's great because my fiance always wants to go camping. And I'm not 100% sure I want that to be our vacation for the rest of our lives. Right. So I'm like, well, we could just rent gear and then we don't have to keep it, which makes me think maybe we'll get to stay at more hotels. But so actually through REI, or actually there's an online site called outdoorsgeek.com or any outfitter that's nearby you, you can rent gear instead of buying it. And at REI, for example, there's a $400 tent. It's a massive two-person tent, beautiful tent. So it costs $400 to buy, but you can rent it for a long weekend for $24, which means you'd have to use it 17 times to make it worth it to buy the tent instead of rent the tent, which is great news for those of us who don't want to go camping 17 times in 1 year.
Wow. And it's in decent condition?
Yeah. I mean, you need to clean it out before you give it back, but they make sure that it's in perfect condition by the time that it gets to you. And I'm sure, they do turnover. So it's not like it's a ragged old used tent. It's a nice tent.
And what about power tools?
Power tools. Summer is a time of home improvement projects. A lot of people, in fact, a recent survey from The Street found that 70% of people are going to be doing a DIY home improvement project this summer. So if you're thinking about doing that, you can save yourself a ton of money by renting power tools from Home Depot or Lowe's. Even your local hardware store might have this option. So, for instance, a diamond saw is like $1,200 to buy. You can rent it, at least in New York City. You can rent it for $60 a day from Home Depot. That way, you save yourself a ton of money. Plus, you don't have to store a potentially dangerous tool in your garage if you're not someone who's going to use it after the summer's home improvement project.
And another way to save money, you can save money on books and movies. Tell us how.
you know, it used to be very common. You bought your favorite books, you bought your favorite movies, and you've got shelves in your home. But those things end up collecting dust, especially now. There's always something new that we want to read or watch. And it's great. There's so many different services out there. You don't have to buy things unless they're your favorite. In fact, the way that I do books is I love the public library. I'm a huge user of the library, which is free. Then if I really, really, really enjoy reading a book, I might go purchase it after the fact. But first, I like to take it for a test run. And of course, there are online services. If you're a e-reader user, you can do this with a site called Scribd.com, Oyster.com, both geared towards books. And as far as movies go, I mean, everyone knows about Redbox and Netflix and all these different services where you don't actually have to purchase the physical DVD, which is probably a technology that's going to change in the near future anyway.
Talking with Lauren Lyons Cole on this edition of On Your Money, I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine. Let's take a call from Linda in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Linda.
Hi, how are you guys?
I'm well. What's your question for Lauren?
Well, I really don't have a question. This is going back to in the beginning when we were talking about saving money out of paychecks, you know, how to begin. And as a single parent living paycheck to paycheck, not now, but 30 years ago, $50 was so daunting for me. If I would have heard someone say you have to spend or save $50 a month out of your pay, it would have just scared me to death. I would have given up and never done anything. But what I did was I took every paycheck and went from say it was $210.50. I would take that $10.50 and stick it right in the savings account. And what that did is it made me save money. And it was a slower pace, and it didn't look like much, but in the end, it did add up. And sometimes that's easier for someone who's living paycheck to paycheck to begin saving. So that was just my comment.
Thanks, Linda.
Oh, I think that's a great, Linda. Thank you for sharing that comment. I think that's a really good piece of advice for anyone who feels like it's daunting to even do $50. Literally, slow and steady does win the race. If it takes you 10 years to get to $10,000, it's better to be working towards that goal.
When you get that extra income and maybe an unexpected bonus or I don't know, a side job, maybe put that in the savings account rather than treating yourself to an ice cream cone or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Every or little you bit maybe
counts.
Do both.
Yeah. There you go. Lisa in Wausau, you're next. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I have a question. I have been struggling trying to keep within my budget every month because it doesn't seem like I have enough income to cover all my bills. My question is I'm sure that there's a lot of people that have that same problem. There's too many bills, not enough income, and I'm working probably more than I ever thought I'd ever have to, and I'm still not making it happen. But my question is, I guess, long story short, is what do I prioritize to always pay first, and what things do I let go for the next month, or how do I rotate paying these bills that works in my best interest?
Thanks, yeah, I agree, Lisa. I think a lot of people are in that boat. And some things you can do right now, you can go and look exactly these bills that you're talking about. These recurring monthly bills that we get sucked into paying, sometimes we can reduce. For instance, if you have a cable bill, try calling the cable company and see if you can talk them into a $20 reduction on your monthly bill. Or if you are at a place where you can move to someplace cheaper, if you're trading in your car, your car insurance, these different things that are ongoing monthly bills, if you can actually get those reduced on a monthly basis, that's going to help a lot. But as far as prioritizing which payment to do first, you know, if there's anything that you can cut out, that's always a good thing. Of course, you need your home, you need your utilities. These are really non-negotiables. There might be some cheaper options as far as cell phone plans go. If you have any credit card payments, by all means, please make sure that you always make the minimum payment on time every month, because if you don't, that can have a big impact on your credit score. So that's a very important thing, and I would definitely prioritize that above putting money into a savings account if we're talking about credit card debt or any debt payment needs to come first.
Okay. All right. And what I've done, like the free spending and trying to snowball on. I have a huge amount of medical debt. Mm-hmm. I have an IRS debt, that kind of thing. I've been working with all of my creditors trying to take advantage of what I can and see if they'll reduce interest payments on things. I don't have a lot of credit card debt. I got sucked into that years ago when I I paid that off. It took me 5 years of diligently paying that off.
Oh, great job. That's amazing.
But it's one of those things where I look at, if I refinance my house and combine all these smaller bills into one, they say not to do that. That's not the best thing. What's your thought on that?
Oh, great. No, this is a good point. I'm glad you're bringing this up, especially with medical debt. Now, there are a lot of programs in place that people don't realize, and you might be aware of this, but at hospitals or with your doctor, if the debt is still held there and hasn't been sent to a collection agency, you should go and tell them, show them your, you know, supporting documents about your income, about your assets, about your other debts, and they will oftentimes negotiate. Especially, this is especially important with seniors, people who are on Medicare. You can get your bill down sometimes 90%. They will remove completely if you pay them on the spot the 10%. I have seen this happen with my own eyes, so I know it's possible. And that can be a great way to tackle the medical debt. The IRS, I got to tell you, make your payments. Don't miss your payments to the IRS. But typically speaking, the interest rates through the IRS, it's one of the best debts you can kind of string out. It's a lot better than credit card debt, as I'm sure you've seen. So when it comes to balancing debt payments, medical debt is something you want to try and try and try to settle. IRS, you can't do that. Just make your payments on time, be consistent. And if you're thinking about consolidating all of those debts, I wouldn't do that until you've already gone down the angle of trying to settle some of this. And I'm not saying settling with credit cards, that's like a different conversation, but the medical debt in particular, hospitals really have an ability to get rid of some of what you owe.
Thanks for that call, Lisa, and good luck. Let's talk to Bill in Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you? I've got a twofold question. We went to see a financial advisor yesterday, and I've heard that there's two different kinds of financial advisors, two different categories. Could you explain that to me? And we were talking about taxes a lot, but a financial advisor is really for investing, isn't he? He says, who do I talk to about? We're selling the farm, and we don't know how to do it. You know, should we sell shares in the corporation? Should we sell the whole thing, or what the heck to do? So we have to talk to somebody who really knows about taxes also. Can you answer those two questions for me?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think when you're it sounds like you're doing the right thing by seeking out financial advice, because you want to make sure if you're selling the farm that you're doing it in this way, the structure that is best for you. So there's a few different things to keep in mind with different financial advisors. Lots of different certifications out there. Now, I'm a certified financial planner, which means anyone who has that designation is able to advise on taxes, investing, insurance, estate planning, retirement, you know, and of course, basic things like budgeting and credit card debt. But you want to look for someone who has that certified financial planner designation if possible. You may also need an accountant of some sort. But depending on if you're working with a certified financial planner professional, they're not going to do your taxes for you, but they can advise you on tax planning, which you're definitely going to need with the farm. So, and then they might have a trusted tax professional that they're working with. Now, and that way you can also get investment advice too. So whatever the revenue you get from selling the farm, you want to make sure that you're investing that in a safe way for your future. With the certified financial planners, you can actually go to letsmakeaplan.org and look for people in your local area that are recommended. You want to make sure that you understand their fee structure up front. So with financial planners, there is a lot of people who are fee only, which means you're just going to pay them sort of like a lawyer on a hourly basis or based on a project like what you're talking about with the farm. Then there's also commission-based income, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but if the person you're working with is paid based on, say, if you sell or if they sell you mutual funds or insurance products, you need to make sure that they're working in your best interest and not just working to get a big commission check.
Thanks for that call, Bill. This is On Your Money. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine, and we're talking with Lauren Lyons Cole this week. She's a financial expert and personal finance contributor to TheStreet.com. Her website is laurenlyonscole.com. Our phone number, if you have any questions, is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at onyourmoney@wpr.org. You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you want to be rich, my guest this week says that you'll want to start out by negotiating a good salary up front when you get your first job. Our guest is Lauren Lyon Coles, a financial expert and personal finance contributor to ForTheStreet.com. Her website is LaurenLyonsCole.com. So, Lauren, how do we negotiate that very first job salary?
This is a great topic, especially for those recent grads who are facing, you know, a lot of student loan debt. Because here's the thing. If you can negotiate $5,000 extra on your first salary, and that might be a lot depending on what the job is, but let's just use that as a reference point. $5,000 extra on your first job over the course of a career, no kidding, amounts to at least $500,000 in extra earning. And that's just assuming that your salary from that point forward goes up based on inflation.
So how exactly do we accomplish that?
When it comes to negotiating, a lot of people get nervous, and that's normal. So I think it's good to recognize that. But there are three main reasons that people do not negotiate. So being afraid is a big one. Not knowing how is another reason, and then not having the confidence. But those are all three things that we can tackle. So being afraid is normal, you know, and even for me, I've been negotiating now for 10 years in various jobs. I still, my voice gets a little bit higher, my face turns red, it's so embarrassing. And I sweat, you know, so you just, I wear the right clothes where people aren't going to see that I'm sweating. And before even going in for negotiating, you can practice in the mirror, you know, you can practice with a friend. Do whatever you can to try to reduce the fear ahead of time and just recognize that those first few minutes you might still have that immediate body, you know, physical response to something that's a little bit scary.
Mm-hmm.
As far as not knowing how to negotiate, there's a lot of resources online. There are great books out there that you can look into to find out exactly what you need to do to negotiate. Of course, knowing what other people, you know, this is something I tell a lot of recent graduates or even people who have been in the workforce for a while. There's not a set salary number for any job. It's just not the way it works. And if you talk to an HR professional, they'll explain this. There's a salary range. So if the range is, say it's $40,000 to $45,000, why would you take a $40,000 paycheck when you could, or annual salary, when you could be getting $45,000? But it's a matter of understanding that range and figuring out how you can explain to the boss that you deserve to fall at the higher end of that range.
You know, a lot of people are afraid that they won't, that the whole negotiation will fall apart and they'll actually lose the job if the negotiation goes bad. What do you have to say to them?
It's just not going to happen. And in fact, interestingly, first of all, I always tell people to try it, right? So you gain confidence by doing it. And I don't think I've ever actually advised someone to negotiate a salary and had them not only not lose a job, but not get the salary increase. I can't even think of an example where someone has come back and said, it didn't work. So generally speaking, even if you just get $1,000 more, what happens is then the boss on the other end respects you more, almost always, because they see that you understand your value and you know that you bring a lot to the table and that you deserve a lot. And from a business perspective, that's the kind of employee you want, because you know that person's going to go out there and hustle and add value to the bottom line of the business. So overall, it's actually a positive. And, you know, if your boss doesn't take you seriously and isn't willing to give you a raise, or, you know, either maybe there really isn't money and maybe you're already at the high end of the range, that's possible. But if you sense that they're not respecting you, there might be some sort of other issue going on. And sometimes there are toxic workplaces. In that case, you start looking for other jobs and you move on.
Mm-hmm. How do we open that dialogue, though, if we've been around for a while and we think it is time for a raise?
This is important to realize. Your boss is not going to come to you. A lot of people expect that you're going to work really hard and eventually your boss is going to say, hey, I've noticed you've been working hard. You got to remember that bosses are busy. They are doing their own thing. They've got their own responsibilities. They've got their own boss. So it's up to you to initiate the conversation. You've got to go knock on the door, say, you know, hey, I wanted to check in with you. Can we get a meeting on the calendar? And then if after you have that meeting, you know, if they say, all right, great, I understand that you want a salary increase, but I need you to do these three things before we're able to give you that increase. When you go back and try to do those three goals that they've given you, you've still got to follow up, because you can never count on your boss to be paying attention to what you're doing and to your paycheck. That is your responsibility, because trust me, they're concerned about their own paycheck.
We're talking with Lauren Lyons Cole on this edition of On Your Money. Kevin McKinley will be back next week. She's a financial expert and personal finance contributor for TheStreet.com, and you might have seen her work in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and The Today Show. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234, or you can email us onyourmoney@wpr.org. Jerry in Milwaukee is on the line. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning to you and your guests. My question has to do with automobile insurance. And as you know, for instance, the state of Wisconsin requires a minimal amount for coverage each year. My question is, I like, A, to have a low deductible, and B, I generally take each liability, the whole menu, exceed what the state requires. My question is there a formula or suggestion for automobile and coverage in terms of, you know, the levels that you choose each year? Because, you know, I don't want to overpay, but insurance is insurance.
Mm. You raise a really good point, actually, and that's insurance is really about risk management. So whether we're talking about automobile insurance or homeowners insurance, renters insurance, even life insurance, but disability insurance, these are all products that what we're doing is we're saying to the insurance company, I'm a little bit concerned about my risk, so I'm going to pool my money instead of insuring myself and making sure I have enough savings to pay for anything that might happen if I get into a car accident. I want to pool my money with everyone else so that you cover my risk. And you know, it's basically a way to take the risk off your own plate. So if you're pretty risk averse, which sounds like you might be since you're going above and beyond with the minimum coverage, it, you know, you might pay a little bit more, but you're paying for peace of mind at the end of the day. Now, if you're a pretty good driver and if you live in, depending on where you live, if accidents really, if you've got a good clean record, I mean, the minimum insurance is not a bad thing to go with because the states put that in place. That's, you know, they're working in the best interest of most of the people in the state. If you are risk averse or a bad driver, then you might want to go above and beyond. And it's not that much more money. So if it makes you feel better.
Sound good, Jerry?
Okay. Great. Sounds good. Thank you very
Thanks
much.
For your call. We'll go next to Gary in Racine. Hi, Gary.
Hi. Say I'm retired, and I do have money in an IRA account, and I'm at the point where I've taken these mandatory distributions.
Mm-hmm.
And what I did about 3 months ago, because of the market risk and turmoil, I really pulled everything out of the it's in mutual funds. You know, bond mutual funds and stock mutual funds. They put all of that IRA money into just a regular money market account. And as I said, I don't really need the money that is coming out. I'm just wondering, moving forward, I don't want to keep it just in that money market account. How will you invest that money?
Investing is always a really good question. And I think that that's where it can really work out well to work with a certified financial planner because investing should be based on your own particular time horizon and goals as well as your risk profile. So like I was saying with the insurance, how risk averse you are. Granted, for most people, what I think is that investing in index funds, low-cost index funds through a company like Vanguard or similar is the best bet. And then you can actually, I mean, depending on how much money we're talking about. So if I'm telling Lizzie, the 26-year-old who we talked to earlier, if I'm telling her to invest in a Roth IRA, she would be a good candidate for something that is a mutual fund that is based on like your retirement, the retirement planning prepackaged mutual funds that you can get. In your situation, it might be better to just stick with bond funds. You sound very young for your age because if you're taking required minimum distributions, I know how old you have to be to have to start doing that. But at that point in your life, it might be better to keep the money out of the stock market. But again, a low-cost index fund, bond index fund would probably be a good bet.
Thanks for that call, Gary. Lauren, you share a list of 5 items we should be sure never to buy in the summer. And cars top the list. Why is that?
Cars top the list because, as you know, many people probably know, summer is a time when the new cars, the 2015s for this year, are starting to hit the lot, and which will continue through the fall. So if you're shopping for a new car right now, you can't quite buy the 2015, and you can't quite get the best deal on the 2014. So if you can hold off a few months, if you know exactly which model you want, hold off a few months so that you have the greatest negotiating power, either getting a better deal on the 2014s that are still on the lot, or 2013s for that matter, or get the newest technology with the 2015.
And what else should we watch out for?
Laptops are actually something I know a lot of kids are going back to school, and so summer is a time to shop for all school supplies. But laptops hit their lowest price in October, right after the college semesters start. So if you've got an old laptop and you can swing, you know, making it work for September, then by October is the best time to hit the stores for your laptop.
Now, if I'm heading out on a nice summer road trip and I might want to take some pictures while I'm out there, what should I do? I shouldn't go out and buy another digital camera?
Digital cameras come out usually at the beginning of the year. A lot of technology often does. So around February is when the newest technology is coming out. And then prices also, you see deep discounts around holiday times. So right now we're in this lull in between. The newest technology hasn't come out, so the sales aren't really happening. It's not holiday season yet. It's really not the best time to invest in a new digital camera. Plus, these days, I mean, just use the camera on your phone. You might save yourself $200 right there. But yeah, so it's not a great time to buy a new digital camera.
And what else should we avoid?
Other things, you know, outdoor furniture. Like I said, everyone's doing home improvement projects. A lot of people want to work on their deck or do like landscaping projects. Right now is when you're going to pay top dollar for a new outdoor grill or new patio furniture. So if you like your old stuff or if you have old stuff that you can keep using, if you can wait until September, maybe even the end of August, go looking for outdoor furniture at that time. You can get amazing deals, like 75% off of the full price items. Just know that those sales go really fast. Inventory goes fast. So you want to get there at the beginning of the sales if that's on your agenda for purchases this year. One other thing to keep in mind, too, airfare. This is not necessarily a great time to be buying airfare. So if you're not doing the road trip, if you're planning to fly somewhere and don't have tickets yet, you want to start looking for locations that are not quite as popular, because that's where you're going to see good deals on tickets. If you're trying to go to Disney World, it's too late. The ship has sailed. You might need to go next year instead.
Well, and if we're going to be traveling, I don't know, in the fall or something, how close to the departure date should we wait before we start shopping for that airfare?
So the magic number currently is about 2 months ahead of time. And I know my parents love to buy their tickets like way early. And I know that makes sense logically, but actually you want to wait until you're a little closer. So if you're going to Disney World next summer, it's way too soon. You can't go this summer and it's too soon to start planning for next summer. So wait until about 2 months out of your trip. And you can set up alerts, you know, kayak.com. Put in your destination, and they'll send you alerts when those tickets do dip down in price.
Mm-hmm. We have just a couple minutes left, but Jerry and Appleton called, and she wants to know, what are the pros and cons of variable annuities?
Oh, boy. We cannot cover that in
right,
just a few
minutes. That's
what
I was afraid of.
You know, and actually these days, it could be a good product for some people. But again, I would direct anyone who's considering that to letsmakeaplan.org. Meet with a certified financial planner. They need to really understand your specific financial picture to recommend that. And there was a long period of time where we really didn't recommend them. And now in some cases it can make sense. But you need to meet with a professional.
Well, any last tips here as we head out? You told us five things to avoid buying in the summer. What are some good deals we might be able to get instead?
Well, summer, like you actually mentioned at the beginning of the show, I think summer is a time to take advantage of all the wonderful free activities, you know, especially if you're trying to get ahead with your emergency fund or your student loans. Go out, you know, do the free concerts in the park, plan picnics with your friends. Summer is the time to enjoy the beautiful weather. This has been such a brutal winter. We all deserve some sunshine and vitamin D. So this should be a time of not spending money. It's really summer. There's a lot of advertising going on because stores are trying to draw us inside into the cool air conditioning. If you can avoid shopping this summer, I mean, all the good deals are going to be coming in the fall and into the holiday season. So get outside and enjoy the sunshine instead.
Well, Lauren, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Cynthia. This has been great.
Lauren Lyons-Cole is a financial expert and personal finance contributor for TheStreet.com. Her work has been featured in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Today Show, and other national media outlets. She's filling in this week for On Your Money, or for Kevin McKinley, On Your Money, here on the Ideas Network. Thanks to Bill Martins for producing the hour and for his on-air direction. Thanks to Christy Taylor for on-air production. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.